The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Welcome back to We the People Radio.
We need
hour
to speak
two.
About them by name.
We are. You are joined by your hosts Elizabeth Woodward, Aaron Ryan, and our engineer Bob Martin.
Doing our 2-hour intro in the second hour because we
slid into home base pretty quick. Hey, so we're chatting and streaming live at WeThePeopleRadio.us, and also on that webpage, you will find out everything you need to know about our guests today and every previous Sunday that we have ever done. 2 years worth, actually. And we're coming up hard on a quick election. We're talking about the work to be done before, during, and most importantly, after. And
This isn't the time to let go of the wheel.
And I want to do another shameless plug for electing locally. Get some private sector experience onto your boards and commissions, folks. Don't look it up. Look at your board of supervisors and see that it's fully stacked by government lifers. Make sure you get some private sector folks in there.
Yeah, because, well, we've seen how well it's worked to have a president who's never had a real job.
Do you know
that's been really awesome.
Our current administration, our president, when he picks his folks for his his cabinet, he has the smallest percentage of private sector experienced
8%.
Folks. 8%. And that is the smallest above that, I think, was 20. That is the smallest amount of private sector experience ever on a president's cabinet. We need the private sector in there, folks, because, big surprise, the private sector funds the public sector.
Well, you know, the thing is, too, when you have to meet a payroll, when you hire people, I mean, just that, you know, when you hire people and you need them to be productive.
You need the right person for the right job.
Well, you can't afford to hire them and let them wander around in the woods for, 6 months until
Or 4 years, as in the case of...
Yeah, or maybe never get productive. Mm-hmm, so if you've never hired somebody who needs to be productive because there are other people's futures depending on it, like the future of your company, I think you just look at the world differently.
And you spend your money wisely because you have no other way to generate income than producing the product you produce. There isn't, there's no influx of taxpayer funding that comes into your business if you make bad decisions.
Well, it's all theory otherwise.
Yeah.
And well.
So focus on the private sector. It's time.
Theory just depends on who you study with, you know?
Mm-hmm.
All right. What do we have over there? What's going on over in Bob's division?
Because I can tell
there?
You want to say something.
Go, Bob.
Oh, well, I was just going to let you know we have our next guest ready to go on the line, Tom Kitcher.
Nice.
I'm ready.
I chatted with Tom yesterday a little bit. I tried not to learn everything, though, so we'd have plenty to learn today. We were talking with him. Let's see. I printed out a little thing here. The Waldo Mining District is in Cave Junction, Oregon. So now we're kind of back to more local resource issues. The first part of the program, we talked about the Forest Service and, what's happening at that federal level that's affecting us locally. Had a question in the chat room in that first part about environmentalists and what happens when they, keep suing everybody and how it's costing us a fortune and all that. And I thought, he's going to love the second hour because Tom is on specifically because KS Wild is suing you guys. And this is not the first time, right, Tom? Is that correct?
Correct. This is correct.
Yeah.
We've been dealing with these issues since the late 1990s, as a matter of fact.
That is just nutty. I was going to give people a little blurb on the Waldo Mining District. You had sent me an email, and it was fascinating. It's been established since April 1st of 1852 in the Oregon Territory and is recognized as the first government in Southwest Oregon. There's a little program note here. The district is an unincorporated association of miners, roughly half of whom hold one or more mining claims within the Siskiyou or other national forests. Historically, and pursuant to the mining law of 1872, mining districts were considered government entities and could make binding rules and regulations within their jurisdiction. I did not know that.
Yes, sir. Well, when the Far West was settled, you know, with the gold rush in California. It was basically what kicked all this off. It had a massive influx of people heading, you know, out west to, they called it seeing the elephant, searching for gold. When they got here, there was no government here. There was no civilization. There was no society. Lots of areas were phenomenally rich in gold, and they attracted literally thousands of prospectors or wannabe miners. And they soon found that they had to have some type of rules to operate under to protect themselves from each other, from new people coming in. They considered their discoveries of minerals and claims to be their property, and they needed a avenue to keep others off of their property so that they could enjoy what they found. And the miners just basically banded together in local areas where they were mining and created their own rules, because there weren't any at the time. Basically, up before they passed the first mine, the federal mining laws, beginning in 1866, the mining districts were basically the local law of the land. They could literally hang you if they wanted to.
Lovely.
Yeah, well,
that is ultimate power, isn't it?
Sure. I don't know if I want that power right at the moment, but
I don't know, there are days.
Yeah. The passage of the federal mining laws, starting in the 1860s, and then with what we call the mining law today, which was passed in 1872, is actually a blend of two earlier acts. It empowered the local miners to create rules within their district that everybody had to operate under. The mining laws, or the mining districts, basically had the function of today's county recorders, in that if you filed a mining claim or discovered a mining claim, you had to file your claim with the local mining district, and they would tell you how big your claim could be, how many claims you could own, how often you had to work it to keep it, and basically all sorts of things. The area I'm in, originally, on the creek that I'm mining, the miners were allowed only one claim, and they only got 30 feet of creek, because there were literally thousands of people trying to mine this one particular creek, because it basically was full of gold. They were finding nuggets the size of footballs. You can just imagine the mess that created. And there was a lot of gunplay and, you know, shady dealings going on and things like that. But it was basically the mining districts that kind of tried to keep everything in control. And then in this area, once statehood was gained, I think in 1859, by the 1860s or so, the state of Oregon had enough influence, I guess. The counties were developed, and a lot of the functions of the mining districts that they originally held was basically transferred over to county control or even state control. And most of the mining districts basically just kind of faded into the past, because there really was no need for them, because we had the federal law now that basically unified under a national law how big claims could be, how many you could own, what you had to do to keep them, and all of those things. So most of the functions of the mining districts are kind of a thing of the past. The Waldo, which was, as far as we know, the first mining district in Oregon, has somehow kept alive, and we've been operating at least since the early 1980s. We don't have any history before that of the district, because we don't know what happened to all the records. They just kind of disappeared.
I can't see a lot of miners being paper pushers.
No.
I just don't see a librarian in the mix.
Yeah, well, we think what happened was they changed the we're in Josephine County, which is Grants Pass, Cave Junction area. When they transferred the county seat several times, and there is some history that some of the records were burned in a fire. don't know if this was deliberate or accidental or what happened, but like I say, a lot of the earliest claim records have disappeared and they're just no longer available. Today what we do mostly is we don't make regulations, even though supposedly under the law we do have the authority to make regulations within our district. All we could really do at this point is further regulate mining, and we definitely feel that we're already regulated plenty enough by the state and the feds. So basically what we're doing now is just trying to protect the rights that we've got from attacks such as this recent attack by Klamath Siskiyou Wild and a couple other organizations, which are the Cascadia Wildlands Project and the Rogue River Keepers.
Yeah, we just love the Rogue River Keepers. We're constantly tripping over them.
Oh,
over here on our side of the line. These groups are no, I can't find it, of course, right this very minute, but I do have a list of their board members on KS Wild. And these aren't, I mean, these aren't like stay-at-home moms, not that stay-at-home moms aren't smart, but I mean, these are people with horsepower. These are folks with money and horsepower, and so you're not being assaulted by some little local environmental feel good group. I mean, this is the environmental machine coming after you.
Oh yes, and I mean, like I say, we've been involved in litigation with them since the late '90s, and it's interesting to note. I just actually got a copy of their recent complaint that they filed on October 22nd, and I noticed. Right off the bat, that the law center that they're using is the same one they've been using for the last 20 years. It's the same people that are driving this. I don't know if I really want to say any names. I mean, people can look this information up for themselves. But I do know that as nonprofit organizations, they have to file tax returns for the nonprofit status. And although you can pull those up on the internet, although you can't get the most recent records, you can usually get records from 2 or 3 years ago and then before then. And it's interesting to note that all of these groups basically have enough funding to literally pay a certain amount of their people, their head people, their directors, a fairly substantial salary. Some of them numbering in the $60,000 range. And it's just kind of interesting to think that these people are basically getting paid to sit around and think of ways to destroy our economy.
that's it in a nutshell.
That does seem sort of counterintuitive. Hey, Tom, we're going to come right back here. We need to thank our advertisers. We've got a two-minute break, folks. Grab a cup of coffee. We are going to talk some more about mining. We're going to get into section dredge mining and give people a little info there. You're listening to KCNR, 1460 AM.
I'm a hard-working man. I wear a steel hard hat. I can ride rope, a hammer and paint, do things with my hands that most men can't. I can't get ahead no matter how hard I try. I'm getting really good at barely getting by.
This is KCNR, the home of Free Fire Media.
Driving over Canaan, singing to my soul. There's people out there finding music in the gold.
We're back. We're with Tom Kitcher, and we're talking about mining and the environmental assault.
Yeah, on everything. But
on anything that
anything
touches
and
the earth.
The trick is, though, with mining, I guess I have a particular empathy for the miners because they're a relatively small group of people. I mean, you probably hang out with miners, huh, Tom?
Oh, yes, I do.
But how many people, how many of the rest of the folks out there, I mean, how many people in L.A. have ever met anybody who have ever mined anything? Like, zero? Two?
The thing is, we don't have a sign on our forehead that says miner.
Yeah, that's...
We look like, generally we look like everybody else. And, we go to the store and buy lots of supplies and things, and most people don't know that, what we're doing is connected to mining. So we just look like everybody else.
Well, it's easy to attack a small group of people who are doing something you don't understand. And one of the big things, can you give us a little primer on suction dredge mining? Don't have to go into the whole thing, but just the idea, because most people, they hear that, they're like, I don't know, they might be wrecking everything.
Sure. basically, what we do, a suction dredge is, you can consider it like an underwater vacuum cleaner. And what we do is we, gold, when it erodes off the mountainside and eventually over time, like take thousands of years, it seeks, because of its high density, its weight, it will seek the lowest point through erosion and other natural processes. Eventually, it usually ends up in some stream or river. And what happens once it gets in the water is during floods and other, you know, large high water flow events, the gold, because it's so heavy, will tend to sink down through the stream bed sediments until it hits a layer that it can't pass through, such as normally is the bedrock itself at the bottom of the stream bed. So we know as miners the best gold is laying on the bedrock underneath the stream bed material. And that material can be anywhere from a couple inches thick to multiple feet, 10, 20, 30 feet deep, thick or more, depending on, you know, the water system you're in. And what we do with the suction dredges is we put on wetsuits, typically. We work underwater. We have an air supply being supplied by a small air compressor on board the dredge, and we have a regulator in our mouth, just like a scuba diver. We just don't have tanks on. We have a hose from the dredge that feeds our regulator, so we have air. And we work underwater. Whatever doesn't fit in the dredge hose, dredges are typically, basically they call like a 4-inch dredge or a 5-inch dredge or a 6-inch dredge. What that's referring to, that inch size, is the size of the suction hose that we're sucking material up with. So for instance, a 4-inch dredge would have a 4-inch inside diameter suction hose on it. And basically, we can suck up anything that'll fit inside that hose. And what happens to that material then? It goes up the hose with the water, and it usually goes to a sluice box, which is very similar to sluice boxes from 100 years ago. They're just a wooden trough. Nowadays, they're usually made out of aluminum. And they have a series of little riffles in the bottom of it with some special carpet that we like to use. And what happens is, if the material and the water pass through the sluice box, the heavier material, such as the gold, if we're lucky, lead and a few other things, because of their weight, that gets trapped behind the riffle system. And the rest of the material just passes through the trough or the sluice and falls off the back end of the dredge back into the creek or the river. Of course, whatever doesn't fit in the hose, and there's a lot of material that does not fit in the hose, like the oversized rocks, we have to move those by hand. So it's suction dredging basically boils down to how fast can you move rocks and for how long. It's a strange kind of thing, but it's an activity that uses muscles in the body that almost no one else ever uses. Try throwing rocks for 3 or 4 or 5 hours a day.
Mm.
And your shoulders will start to ache and your elbow joints will ache. It can be fairly destructive on our bodies, but most people are doing it actually because it's fun. There's also, you can make a fair amount of money at it, especially at today's prices of gold. We get attacked. One of the things the environmentalists use against us is that a lot of people are doing it for recreational purposes. The mining law, the federal mining law, grants a right to anybody. Basically, any citizen of the United States or even a non-citizen that has declared their intent to become a citizen has the right to exercise the granted rights of the mining law, which are basically Congress back in the 1860s and 1872 basically declared that the public domain lands, not to be confused with just the regular public lands, but we're talking public domain, and by definition, those are lands that are open to appropriation. And that means these were lands that Congress intended to eventually pass into private ownership. And originally we had some homestead laws where you could, you know, basically go out in the wilderness and carve out your little 40 acres or 60 acres or whatever they were allowing. And as long as you did the required amount of work, which was usually build a cabin and clear so many acres, eventually you gained title to that land. Well, most of the homestead laws, as far as I know, are long gone. The only law that's still on the books that allows citizens to appropriate or claim the federal lands is the mining law. So there's kind of a problem in the mindset of a lot of people, including the environmentalists and even the court system, is they don't recognize that once we've filed a mining claim, that land is no longer considered private, or is no longer considered public land. It is considered private property. Even though we don't have clear title to the land itself, we do have the title to the minerals. And along with that comes in the U.S. codes, it's the exclusive enjoyment of all the surface within the boundaries of our location, or within the boundaries of the mining claim.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of sometimes wonder, how can that right be exclusive if we're sharing it with such things as salmon and spotted owls and, timber management on some of the forests and things like that? There's a conflict built into the law. The mining law predates all of this, and it basically grants an exclusive right of ownership. And yet this has been totally infringed year after year by agencies, basically run amok, over-restricting, getting carried away. And then, of course, the environmental machine has just carried this basically to the nth degree, to the point that they've almost totally destroyed, they have basically destroyed the Western timber industry, as far as I know. In the county I'm in, Josephine County, just 20, 30 years ago, there were over 20 operating lumber mills in the county, and now we're down to one that's operating kind of part-time. They're having a little bit harder time getting rid of the miners, though.
I know that many of them are having to go out of state for work, just because they're being besieged. When we come back with Tom, we need to talk a little bit about some of the assertions that mining is a problem, that it's hurting fish, that all these different things. There's a lot of myth being perpetrated by the environmentalists, and we need to get some facts out to people. So whether or not you have personal contact with mining yourself or friends or anything like that, this is a group of people who have a private property right. At the end of the day, Tom and I talked about this yesterday. It's like if you owned your house and you were only, what did we decide, Tom? It'd be like if you were only allowed to live there a few days a year, right?
Right.
That's about the good comparison. So yes. It's your house, but you can only live in it a few days a year. And that's about what they're facing.
It'd be like telling Walmart that you can sell retail goods out of your store, but only for a couple days a year.
Yeah, yeah.
How could any business operate that way?
Right. And you own it, but you don't own it, and you can't control it. And this is why, except the reasons that they've come up with are largely manufactured reasons. So we're going to take a quick break. I think we have an update from the Central Valley on a campaign issue, and then we'll be right back with Tom. You're listening to We the People Radio here at KCNR 1460, Shasta Redding, the home of Free Fire Media.
Join the conversation in our chat room, KCNR1460.com.
Spooky.
Nice. Agenda 21 song.
Yeah. Welcome back to We the People Radio. We're talking about mining and environmental issues and the battle against crazy people. But on that note...
On the note of crazy people...
We're going to segue into the epitome of stealing campaign signs.
Exactly. Hang with us, Tom. We'll be right back with you. We've got Russ Wehmeyer on the phone from... Now, Russ, are you with Central Valley Tea Party or Bakersfield Tea Party?
I'm actually with the Fresno's War. I'm more affiliated with, and I've spoken at several of their events, and thank God for the Tea Party.
And thank you.
Yeah, otherwise we'd have to, I don't know what we'd do with our free time. I guess we'd have to watch Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah.
Go figure. Well, the Tea Party fundamentals, what I like is fiscal irresponsibility, and we really don't care which side of the aisle you're on. If you are fiscally irresponsible, you're going to destroy this country and the state.
So down there, speaking of people that are destroying the state, you guys have put up some big trailers. These are the kind of big box trailers that get hauled with 18-wheelers. And, I mean, talk about making a statement, right? You guys built your own billboards. And I'm looking at pictures of them. I will have them posted on the website here. I've got to send them to Robert. But it says, "Stop the Politicians' Created Water Crisis." It has Boxer, Costa, and Pelosi in a circle with a line through it. And the other one says, "Jim Costa is killing Valley farms and jobs. He supports high-speed rail, boondoggle, and Valley water sales." So
exactly,
these trailers magically have been disappearing.
Yes, unfortunately, as we've approached closer and closer to this election cycle, these trailers are placed on private property. Many of these farmers are going to be directly impacted by high-speed rail, and they've been impacted by water shortages. And it's not just the water shortages. Congressman Jim Costa and Nancy Pelosi and Feinstein, they've recently passed water legislation that allows water sales and transfers to more readily be sold and transferred out of, let's just say, the farming areas into these urban areas that can afford to pay a lot higher prices for it. And that's just going to stifle the economy even further in our rural areas. And the high-speed rail issue is fundamentally is so fiscally irresponsible. For your listeners, if we'll recall, it started out as $33 billion for an 800-mile electric train system. Well, I'm kind of a numbers guy because I'm in business for myself. I have to watch a budget. Well, at that rate, at $33 billion for 800 miles, that was $41 million a mile to construct. Then once that bond passed, you give it a couple of years, they come back and say, "Well, we want to spend $98 billion for 800 miles. Well, that jumps the price to $120 million per mile.
And Costa is a major proponent of this. He is your congressman. And he's running against, who's he running against?
He's running against Brian Whelan, who is a conservative and fiscally responsible businessman, and his family's been in farming and represents the Valley issues, I think, well for us, and we hope he wins. And even now, like on high-speed rail, the current proposal is at $68 billion, but they reduced the amount of miles to 520, and the price went up to almost $140 million a mile. So it may sound like they're going to spend less, but you're getting less track, and it's no longer the 520-mile proposal that's on the table now. It's not electric train either.
Right. We've done several programs on high-speed rail. So I don't mean to cut you off on that part, but I wanted to focus really on we've got a congressman running a guy running for Congress up here, and the sign for that campaign is being slashed into like 15 pieces.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that because then we're on track.
Wait a minute. Are you sure about that?
I guess that's what's driven us to the point that
yeah.
so many of our newspapers have been consolidated, we have a hard time getting our message out. So landowners and farmers and business concerned people, we've had no choice but to put signs and banners on our own property. And what's disturbing to us is this is a violation of our freedom of speech rights when people are coming on their private property, stealing the trailers. And I got a call from one of our farmers yesterday, and I'm going to go take a picture of the banners tomorrow, but he found where they had towed one of the trailers to and had tore off all the signs and banners and discarded them and then towed the trailer somewhere else. And we're going to go take a picture of that tomorrow for the for
folks,
the authorities.
These are not small banners. I mean, these are the entire side. I'm assuming they're on both sides of these cargo trailers. Are they?
Yeah, right. We've even done some of them in Spanish so that our Spanish neighbors understand what we're up against. And
I saw that. I didn't read that one because I don't speak Spanish.
So what's the legal penalty?
They just totally disregard and respect private property rights, and it's got a lot of people upset.
So what's the legal penalty? Is it what's the legal penalty on carting one of these cargo trailers off?
You know, the problem is we've had a hard time to even get our local authorities to come out and make a report on it because they kind of rate the value of that as it's a nonviolent crime in their opinion. Mm-hmm. And the value of what was stolen is not that high. They're busy chasing people with guns.
You got bigger delta smelt to fry.
Friday to meet with the authorities, and they got a call on some bad guys doing an armed robbery, and we were not able to connect, but we're hoping to meet with them tomorrow.
Well, I thought it was cool because this is what perked my interest and why I wanted you to pop on here, because they've stolen four. I mean, this isn't like they hauled away somebody's yard sign.
An accident.
No, they hauled away four of these things and ripped all the stuff down. This is on Highway 99, and then two trailers stolen off Highway 152 in Merced County. You guys have put up a $1,000 cash reward, it says, for information leading to the recovery of the trailers stolen off private property. You allow them to remain anonymous. So not only have you guys had to pay for the banners to have these trailers out of service for whoever they belong to, you guys have gone to all that expense. Now you have to pay for a reward to figure out who's taking down your ability to get this message out before the election. That's a lot to ask.
We're hoping that there will be some people that affiliated and have knowledge of that, because the people and the farmers that I'm familiar with and work with, they're upset about this. And they feel violated that these people have come onto their private property and stole the trailers. In the one incident, they pulled the trailer up and were not too far away from the farmer's daughter and his family, their family, where they had disassembled the trailer and then took off. And, you know, they always wonder, okay, you run into somebody like that, how desperate are they going to be? What are they going to resort to? And
well, it tells you guys must be, if you weren't a threat, they wouldn't do it. So,
that's the ironic thing, Aaron, that's kind of getting to us. You like to not think that there is a conspiracy, but in many of these locations, there are other trailers sitting there that do not have any signs on them. If they were just wanting to steal the trailers to go trash them for metal.
Oh, I'm sorry. Was that one of the trailers?
Why would they take the ones with signs when there's other trailers sitting right there
in the
neighborhood?
Okay,
none of that. On
it never occurred to me they were stealing the trailers because they wanted the trailer. That never crossed my mind. Actually, I figured they just wanted to rip the signs off. All right, Russ.
Yes.
We thank you for your man on the street report.
Thank you so much for calling in.
We look forward to your pictures. We will post them. Please email them to me when you get them, and we'll pop them on the webpage. And please keep us posted as things play out. Would you shoot me an email when you guys find them or don't find them or? And
one of the things we found, the ones that are getting most disturbed on Highway 152, which is from 99 on track, you know, that's the access point to the Bay Area. So I guess maybe there's some people traveling that highway that don't appreciate the signs. But it's our only means of affordable communication that we have, and we're gonna continue.
Well, you keep scaring them. You're doing a good job.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, guys, in the Central Valley. We're with you way up here in Northern California.
Well, thank you.
We're welcome. Talk to you later, Russ. Okay, we're coming back with Tom. We're going to take a quick break so we don't have to interrupt him again, and then he's going to finish out the hour. We're going back to suction dredge mining. Whew! Busy day here at We the People Radio, KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Redding, the home of Free Fire Media.
Streaming 24/7 on KCNR1460.com.
All the gold in California is in a bank in the middle of Beverly Hills. It's somebody else's name. So if you're dreaming about
truer words were never spoken. Welcome back.
Yeah, I was listening to that song. All the gold in California, you can't have it anymore because they've basically shut out most mining down there.
Yeah, yeah, that's we kind of it's funny, you know, Oregon.
And the bank in Beverly Hills is in receivership.
That's true.
And then there's that.
Da-da-da. you know, well, the part that always kind of strikes me as just craziness is it used to be Oregon. I mean, we used to look at you guys and go, oh, my gosh, I mean, what are those guys doing up there? And now people are fleeing to Oregon because you have more, well, you have less regulation than we do in a lot of cases, especially with timber harvest and stuff. But, okay, go back to the mining. We had a call that came in. Bob, tell me what that was again. Oh,
it was Carl.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember that part. That was where that's where my memory stopped. Carl called.
Asking about, just for clarification, are they allowing part-time dredging in Oregon now?
Generally, the suction dredge mining in Oregon is set. There's a in-water work period, which is designed, is designated, or designated is the right word, but it's the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife sets this in-water work period to protect fish, spawning beds, fish reds in particular, the eggs. Generally speaking, for most of Oregon, our season that we're allowed to be in the water is generally from June 15th through September 15th. So we basically get 3 months out of the year to conduct our business, and then the other 9 months out of the year we are supposed to stay out of the water, and this is to protect young fish and fish eggs in particular so that we don't suck them up or bury them with our tailings. And most of us live with that, and it's okay, because most of us want to do this in the summer. It's not really pleasant getting in water that's in the 30 or 40 degree range. Although some people, if you want to work outside that window, you can ask for a variance, and sometimes they'll grant it. Because Oregon didn't do what California did, where your Fish and Wildlife went and basically studied every creek or stream and designated certain sections. Some areas were open year-round, some areas were closed year-round, and then other areas were somewhere in between. In Oregon, they just kind of made this blanket statement that covers whole counties or even you know, large portions of the state. And they just say, well, we've got fish that hatch or lay their eggs during these months out of the year. So generally speaking, you can't get in the water and do anything. This affects other activities other than just mining, even bridge construction and things like that. They have to follow this in-water work period unless they get a variance. And you can get a variance if Fish and Game can come out and see that there are no fish in this particular, like there might be a big waterfall below you that obviously the fish can't get up, therefore there's no reason in the world you can't dredge other times of the year. But generally we get 3 months.
Hmm. And then down here we're no, mostly no, and sort of no.
Well, now since the moratorium went into effect, there's no suction dredging allowed at all in California, from what I understand.
And at that point, you have a ton of people who have a private property right that has now been absolutely violated.
Oh, for sure.
They no longer even get to live in the house for 2 days out of the year. I mean, it's like,
yeah.
You guys pay property.
Own the house and you can pay taxes on it.
That's what I was curious about.
But you can't do anything with it
because you pay property taxes on these claims, right?
No, well, in California, yes, they do. In Oregon, we have a statute that they cannot tax the mining claim itself.
Jeez, again, Oregon is making more sense than California. There's something really, I mean, hey, good for you. Oh, I'm so scared. Okay, so
15 years ago, we could not have wrapped our minds around that notion.
I'm having a hard time right now. But when you guys, you know, you're running these little vacuum cleaners in the river bottom, and I know there's a lot more detail than that, but okay, you're doing that. So they're, one of their big claims, the environmentalists, one of their big claims is that you're putting mercury in the rivers.
Oh, yes. Right.
Love that one.
How exactly?
Well, not, but.
Yeah,
we're actually not. What we're actually doing is removing mercury from the river or the stream. The mercury got in the rivers for the most part. Some of it's natural. Mercury is a natural element, occurring element. In certain areas, there is cinnabar and other minerals that have mercury in them. A lot of the mercury in particular that they're worried about was used by the miners 100 years ago or 150 years ago, basically in the heyday of the hydraulic mining, where they had the big, huge water cannons that were capable of washing whole mountainsides away. Mercury has an affinity for gold, or gold has an affinity for mercury. I'm not sure which it is, but gold sticks to mercury. Clean gold will stick to clean mercury. So if the miners found that if they were mining in areas where there was a lot of real small particles of gold, the best way to catch that in a sluice box was to line the inside of the sluice box with mercury. So they'd go dump whole 60, 70-pound flasks of mercury into the sluice box, and then they'd run all their material through it, hoping that the gold would stick to the mercury. And it generally did, but in that process, a certain amount of the mercury would splash out of the sluice box and escape and get into the river system, where it generally, because it's so heavy, it generally tends to just sink to the bottom, similar to gold. Today, the modern day, the suction dredgers, we don't use mercury. We don't line our sluice boxes with mercury. We don't have any mercury on the dredge. Generally, we don't use it at all. But what happens is on very rare occasions, we might come across, especially if we're mining below a historically mined hydraulic site. I know in some of the rivers in the Motherlode country down in California, there's quite a few of the large hydraulic mines where they used a lot of mercury and they lost a lot of it. And occasionally the modern suction dredger now might come across small pools of liquid mercury in the sediment or down on the bedrock. And Fish and Game down in California, or Fish and Wildlife, decided to investigate how much mercury was the suction dredge keeping and how much was escaping from the suction dredge if they sucked any liquid mercury up. And their, I'm not really call it a study, but whatever their experiment with this, their conclusion was that the dredge safely recovered up to 98% of the mercury out of the stream bed sediment. And normally, I mean, I think most people would think that, wow, here we've got a group of people that are out safely removing 98% of mercury out of the water systems.
Yeah, that should be a good thing, but we know that's probably not. Yeah, because that's what common sense would tell us.
But they never mention the 98% that we're recovering. What they mention is 2% might escape the dredge and fall back into the water.
That was there before.
That was, yes, it was.
Yeah, you didn't put it there. Oh. Hey, I hate to butt in on this part because that's just one of the big things. So we've got to follow up on that. We only have 2 minutes left. And so I wanted to direct people back to the website at wethepeopleradio.us. If you go there and you look at this show, I want you to look down the page a little bit and you'll get information on the Waldo Mining District and on this lawsuit. Just so that people can follow along. And I need for you to keep us posted on what's happening with this. We're going to have to, obviously, I'm sorry, we had the little campaign blurb that ran long in the middle, but we need to have you come back on and keep us up to speed on what's happening with the River Keepers and with KS Wild. Because
I'd be happy to.
They're coming for everybody. I mean, you guys are not alone. You know,
they started with the timber industry, and they're working their way down the food chain from there.
Yeah, I mean, right here in the thing, the suit maintains that these reviews called consultations are required under the Federal Endangered Species Act before dredgers can operate. This is just going to, as long as we can find an endangered species somewhere where there is water, they can pretty much eliminate mining for you. Am I close?
Well, they're going to try.
I mean, that's kind of the goal, right?
Yeah, yeah. When I got out to Oregon, there was a bumper sticker that the environmentalists were using, and it was basically logging through by 92, mine free by 93.
Nice.
No kidding.
Nice.
And that's basically been the mindset ever since.
And you guys are also looking for some help, and that's why I wanted you on right away, even though we didn't have a ton of time. You guys are looking for help, so if people would like to help them with their legal defense fund, please go to the website and get the information there. $20 isn't too much. They just need a little bit of support in order to get their suit through, and they are a small group that represents all of us. Thank you, Tom, for coming on and representing mining. I will talk to you off the air, and we will get the rest of the story out here, okay?
Oh,
thanks
thank
for
you
listening,
very much,
folks.
Aaron.
Thanks a million.
KCNR, Shasta, Redding.